You're about to hear the opinions, suggestions, and observations of a licensed real estate broker in California. Since each situation can be unique, do not consider anything said here as legal advice for your specific needs. Always seek out the advice of a suitable professional in your area for advice tailored to your situation. Please remember that when following advice, your results may vary. Please also understand that the information provided here is not intended to cover all aspects of the subject material, but rather a sample of issues the speaker considers important.
Ah! You seem to understand. I'm not locked in here with you. You're locked in here with me.
Hello, everyone. That makes me laugh every time I hear it. Welcome to another edition of Real Estate Realities with the Rebel Broker. My name's Robert Whitelaw, and I am the Rebel Broker. Licensed real estate broker in the state of California, member of the National Association of Realtors, but please don't hold that against me. Hope you all have had a great week. We're going to talk about a couple of interesting subjects today. If you'd like to chat, ask any questions, whatever, you can head on over to therebelbroker.com. You can follow the links there to the show and ultimately end up at the chat room for the show. You can also dial in at 877-503-5033. That's 877-503-5033. You can either listen live there or you can get in the queue and you can ask me a question and I'll be happy to answer it for you, or at least to be able to answer as much of it as I can. And if I need to get more information, then I might I'll answer that on a later show or something like that. But usually these are questions we can explore live. So feel free to dial in. As a reminder, remember that within the next few months, the show is going to be migrating off of Blog Talk Radio. So if you are following the show using the feed directly from Blog Talk Radio, or you're subscribing to it within Blog Talk Radio, you are going to want to not do that. The first thing that will happen is that the Rebel Broker website is going to get a facelift. I had a listener contact me recently and I asked him for some feedback, and I encourage any of you to give me feedback as well. But one thing that he noted was that it was really hard to search old shows really track down shows at the Rebel Broker website, you know, and it's virtually impossible to do that because none of them are actually stored there. And I don't create an entry for each show. I've actually always thought of each show as semi-disposable, since a lot of times we were talking about news of the day. And it doesn't really help you to listen to news of the day from a year before. But one thing that will be cool about the new way we're going to be doing the show is they'll all be on the site. So you'll be able to listen to them live at the site. You'll be able to participate live at the site. And in addition to that, you'll be able to search past shows very easily using either tags or the name of the show, that type of thing. And those were some of the things that I got as feedback that this person really wanted. They wanted to be able to do a search on specific topics to look at old shows. Now, the bad news is that this won't apply to any old shows. As I mentioned, all the shows I've done on Blog Talk Radio are owned by Blog Talk Radio. So my understanding is I can't take all of those off and put them on my site and then use them in that way. Anything that I did before Blog Talk Radio, from 2007 till 2011 or 12, all of those I still own and I have them somewhere. I suppose if someone really wanted to listen to shows that are that old, we could do that. Not real high on my priority list to work through that list. In fact, just getting through the site and getting it being the focal point is really the focus right now. So if you have feedback you'd like to give, you know, what sort of topics have you enjoyed the most? Would you be looking for? I mean, obviously, I've been focusing more on delivering being able to continue to deliver the show live and also facilitate the folks who don't listen live, which is the vast majority of you. I was just looking at my stats this morning, and something like 95% of you consume it on a mobile device, so like a cell phone or an iPad or whatever. You know, the vast majority of you are accessing it in that way using some app. It could be Stitcher, it could be iTunes, and iTunes is a huge chunk. Stitcher is another really big chunk. If there are other venues that you like to consume stuff, if you have to jump through odd hoops to get at my content, let me know what you use. I'm happy. Most of these places that will serve as a portal for me to provide content to you so you can subscribe to it, typically all they need from me is an RSS feed, and I'm already providing that. So all I need to do is point them to my RSS feed, and suddenly my show is on their portal. So since this is work that's just getting started now, in fact, I'm just sort of putting together the building blocks of how I want to implement this, your input right now, it would absolutely have an effect on how this pans out. It already has. I've had, as I mentioned, I recently had someone call me or email me. I've had other folks contact me with ways they would prefer to consume the show. The whole reason we're on Stitcher at all is because I had a listener say, hey, you know, I prefer to get stuff through Stitcher. Is there any way you can get up on Stitcher? I checked it out. It was easy to do. So I did it. And within just a couple of weeks of his request, we were up on Stitcher. So I absolutely want to make this as easy for you to consume as possible. And I, you know, this show has obviously evolved from sort of a therapeutic process on my part to just disgorge myself of all these frustrating things into sort of a news, how to part of my business thing. So, you know, I'm interested in giving the public what they want in terms of what they get from the show. So feel free to send me feedback. Send those. Go over to www.therebelbroker.com and send it there. You will absolutely be seeing changes up on the Rebel Broker. In fact, in the research I've been doing, it may require a complete redo of the site, which would mean we'd probably lose all the folks who've registered at the site. We may or may not lose them. A lot of them are clearly spam creations of accounts, and I'd almost rather start clean and have a much more robust filtering process so that we just get real folks who are registered, because I'm also considering doing a newsletter. So depending on where you care about that, whether you like to be able to read something. But one other cool thing is I'm going to be able to add video to the content with the way I'm going to be delivering this. So I was hoping to find out from you whether or not you would be interested in that. It would be a great way for me to show graphs and do it. I'm not doing this because I want you to see my face. I'm as ugly as they come. So there's absolutely no point to make it a video experience so you can look at my ugly mug while we have these discussions. But it might be a good opportunity for me when we're talking about things that might graphically be better discussed to have that up and be able to, so that you can look at that. But again, right now, most of you are consuming this as an audio only product. Well, all of you are, because that's what it is. And judging from what I hear, I mean, people are, my good buddy who's in Iowa tells me he consumes it while he's on his walks. I get people telling me they're listening to it in the car. So it doesn't really sound like it's an appropriate thing for me to add video to this show. So what may end up happening is there may be some other thing, maybe a once a month video thing that would be on a separate feed or a separate sort of provision thing. Well, I have to see. It really depends on what you all want. I've really sort of massaged my workflow. There were too many times I was having to put the show off and do other things. The way the show will be going now, the new way the show is going to be doing, I can pretty much, if I can't do it on a specific day at a specific time, it'll be easier for me to do it at some other time when I can backfill on those instances where something conflicts. It'll be easier for me to do a makeup show either later the same day or right around it. So anyway, all things I'd love for you all to bounce around in your heads. And this is a great opportunity for anybody who's a fan of the show to provide feedback and let me know what they think could make the show better. So head on over to www.therebelbroker.com and send me a message. There's a contact Robert tab right there in the upper right. Just click on that bad boy and get in contact with me. In terms of other house cleaning type of things, a listener recently sent me a link to the People. Is that what it's called? I looked at it just long enough to realize I never wanted to look at it again. The People of Walmart? Is that what it was? So just Google that. Google the People of Walmart. I was trying to think, how would that fit into someone's life? I suppose the best way to fit that into your life is if you're at a point where you're feeling really bad about yourself and things are looking horrible and you think you're just a complete screw up, go visit that site and nothing will make you feel more normal, no matter how odd you might be. So I thought I'd throw that out there as a public service. So the primary topic today is foreclosure data. We're going to spend some time talking about that. We'll hit a few other stories first, but it's really kind of interesting. So many people just listen or just acknowledge or digest the headlines of so many stories. And there have been a few foreclosure stories that have come out. I've actually tweeted them that might light a fire in your head and make you think we're in a weird place with foreclosures and they're coming back. We'll actually look a little bit more deeply into that and discover exactly what we should be thinking about foreclosures. They are up. So we'll chat about that and find out if it's something we should really be worried about. Other things I wanted to talk about today, there's some really interesting topics. We spent a lot of time talking about buyers' things last time, how to pick an agent. Came at it from both sides. We talked about what buyers and sellers should both be thinking when they're picking an agent. So I encourage you to look at that. What's interesting is, you know, I do a show similar to that once a year. And every year, there's a little bit more, a slightly different angle that comes in on it. So, you know, I no longer freak out that I'm doing a show I've already done before because so many times we'll end up getting slightly different perspectives on it and a couple of other different little tidbits to throw in there. So, and people, those are the shows people love. I guess it's a fallacy on my part to think that just because I've done X number of shows that y'all have listened to every one of them. So I'm not, for most of you, I'm not repeating myself. Because most people haven't been listening since January of 2007. So I'm just going to stop worrying about it. I know, and I know I've said that before, but now I really mean it. I'm going to stop worrying about it. So let's go ahead and jump in first. The first story for today is going to be five cities poised to be the next Silicon Valley tech hub. Now, why would we care about that? As folks who really are here just to have a chat about real estate. Well, for those of you who aren't aware, Los Altos, California, recently became the most expensive market in the United States with a median sales price of $2.3 million. Well, let's discuss why that is. It's because of Silicon Valley. It's because it's a tech hub. So wouldn't it be nice if you could go into the Wayback Machine and visit Los Altos and buy a house in Los Altos? Way back in the olden days of the 80s or the 90s and enjoy the crazy appreciation that Los Altos has enjoyed. Now, just to give you a little bit of a perspective, when I started in real estate back in 88, Los Altos was one of my areas. The company I worked for was a Century 21 office. Century 21, what was the name of my office? Was it Century 21 Gold? I'm not sure it was. The broker in charge was Don Duff, and he used to have Donald Duck on his business cards. And I used to tell him that he's going to be in big trouble. Disney's going to come and sue him for putting that on his business card. I don't know if that ever happened. But anyway, so back then, we used to do quite a bit of work in Los Altos, and particularly Los Altos Hills. And it evolved into a very high-end area. In fact, Los Altos Hills is a step up from Los Altos in terms of price. So much so that the folks who lived in Los Altos Hills felt horribly insulted that they were forced to share a zip code with the folks from Los Altos. Now, the population of Los Altos Hills absolutely did not warrant their own zip code, but they got one because that's where all the expensive houses were. So I was there when that was going down, or at least right after when it went down. And I remember us buying land up there and then subdividing it and building homes up there. This would be, let's see, I was with the national chain for, I think, 2 years. And then I switched to a small independent that was much more investment-oriented, investor servicing. And that was the company that would buy lots and do other types of things and make money that way. And back then, I was, and the only reason I'm reminded of this is I was going through an old box of real estate stuff. And back in the day, back then, I was a very odd realtor because I had my quote unquote portable Mac. It was a Mac Plus in a big soft case. I had my image writer in a soft case. I'd carry this stuff around in my trunk and I'd set up my computer and I'd do stuff. So I was using my computer to create the material to do the promotional stuff for these properties. And sometimes we'd send it out to a printer and get it all printed out nice and glossy and beautiful. And other times we would get a hold of way back then, this was very expensive. We'd get a hold of a laser printer. And if I'm not mistaken, I actually bought an Apple laser printer of the day and started using that and created these great little I was a geek. What can I say? In any event, I found one from the very first house that we where we subdivided the lot into acre parcels and then sold them. And it was for $1.2 million, which was a ridiculous amount of money in what would have been 91 or 92, 90, right in that ballpark. And I went and I took a look at the same area now, and those homes in that area were selling for closer to $3 million. I think the one we built then had sold most recently for $2.8 or $2.9 million. So, you know, that's a lot of appreciation. Los Altos is crazy. And the reason why Los Altos is crazy is that's where all the high tech guys live. If you're the guy who I have a good friend of mine who lives, his father lives in Los Altos Hills. His next door neighbor was the CEO of Apple when Gil Amelio was the CEO of Apple. Just about every big CEO has got a house in Los Altos Hills. That's what built that up. You can say the same for areas like Palo Alto and Cupertino, Sunnyvale, Santa Clara, areas that are crazy right now where homes sell almost immediately. So what did we create? We didn't just create expensive homes. We created expensive homes that sell really quick. So if that's going to come down the pike in other areas, wouldn't you like to know? Now, in addition to that, imagine being able to cross-reference a list like this with our already existing knowledge of explorations of good areas to invest that we've already kind of put under our belt that are independent of the high-tech part, that are attractive to us because they have some of the other fundamentals of great investments, like having a college or university within the town, that type of thing. Having a diversity of industries in the area. You know, these are all great things. There are certain areas that are one trick ponies that really rely on one industry or one thing. And if that one industry or thing went away, so would the town. So having a little bit of a diversification is also a really good thing. And these are things we've talked about in previous shows. So let's go ahead and check out this list. Now, so what this list is, this comes to us from Forbes, and it's a list of emerging tech hubs, which they say have characteristics similar to Silicon Valley before its real estate boom. And these are some of the things that are included in this list. Relatively low housing costs, low unemployment rates, median tech salaries higher than the median salary for the city's total workforce, the presence of major tech companies, venture capital funding to spawn new businesses. All right. So we're talking about all the things that tend to nurture high tech, innovative things. Now, these have become sort of the way to measure things simply because people look constantly at Silicon Valley to figure out what the success factor was. What was it that brought Silicon Valley into being Silicon Valley? And these are some of the elements that they saw being big elements in that. Okay. So the first one on the list, and this is going to sound very familiar. We have talked about this town dozens of times. Last year, it was on my list to go to visit for possible investments because Round Rock, Texas, just north of it, was listed as one of the best places to invest in last year because of the amount of growth that people were expecting to see there. I would still love to do it. It didn't end up happening for me last year for a variety of different reasons. A couple of personal reasons that sort of distracted me from other things that were business related I should have been doing. So Austin, Texas, arguably, this is a quote from the article, most attractive of these tech hubs has been Austin, which has a young, educated population and a large VC presence, venture capitalist presence, along with a burgeoning restaurant and music scene. Now, I've been going to Austin for a long time for a variety of reasons. There was a time period when I had family there. I also used to go there for South by Southwest. I haven't gone in quite a few years. I probably haven't gone, I think, since the late 90s for South by Southwest. But Austin, another one of those towns that's very dynamic. It feels very much like Silicon Valley did a long time ago. Now, I grew up in Silicon Valley, so I'm pretty aware of what the feel was or the vibe. Austin is different from the rest of Texas. Austin is far more of a liberal place. So depending on what your personal bents are, that's either good or bad. But it's also got a lot of diversification in terms of arts and obviously music. It's considered they consider themselves the live music capital of the world. Probably not unearned. I would tend to agree with that. It's pretty amazing. If you haven't been to a South by Southwest and you ever get the opportunity, I'd suggest you go. It's a pretty good time. It's also the home to Dell. Austin continues to be popular among venture capitalists, boasting 17 companies on the Inc. 5000 list, including one of the country's most promising companies, mobile app developer Funware. As for job growth, Austin Technology Council predicts that 9,000 new tech jobs will be created in 2017, a big reason why Austin ranks second on Forbes' list of best U.S. cities for future job growth. The real estate outlook, according to Forbes, is also very popular. The Urban Land Institute and PricewaterhouseCoopers ranked Austin second on the list of U.S. markets to watch, and we discussed that here. Real estate purchase price medium is $216,000. It's among the leaders in urban growth, 8.6%. The report also ranks Austin as the number one market for home building, second for investment, and fourth for development. And I don't know if this is interesting or not, but there's actually a builder based in Austin who does a YouTube channel. And he's awesome. So if you're someone who's looking at being interested in the Austin area in building, go ahead and email me. Head on over to therebelbroker.com and email me, and I'll go to the trouble of, you know what? I could tell you just right now, if everyone's willing to be patient with me for just the quickest of moments, I can actually see if I can't find out what this guy's channel was. Let's see here. I just watched something. He recently did a video, how to stay warm at the work site, which couldn't be more boring. But he uses really top-notch gear for his stuff. He has these amazing things he does with hidden doors and just really, if you're looking for classic old world stuff, maybe not the guy for you. But if you're looking for a very modern take on construction and on design, he does great work with architects in terms of coming up with really amazing solutions for folks in their homes. If you're looking for something that's going to be very designed specifically for you, this is probably going to be your guy. Come on, where are you? You know, I don't subscribe to that many channels. I'm kind of stunned to see all this stuff since the last time I looked in. Really compelling audio here. I wish I could come up. Maybe I should sing a song while I'm trying to find this. Hold on. Let me actually do a search. I swear, I don't understand why I'm not seeing it. I can't remember the guy's name. Am I just going to have to give up on this because I can't find him? How did I end up subscribing to so many people? Yeah, I'm not going to be able to find it. I feel like a complete idiot. Yeah, I'm just not finding it. I feel like a complete boob for wasting your time. All right, well, we'll move on. If you're interested, I promise I will take the time to go track this guy down. And see if I can't see. Whenever I get something stuck in my craw, this is how I get. It's just like I have to find it. God, it's painful to be me sometimes. All right, I'm gonna move on. So all right, anyway, let's talk a little bit more about the topic, which is up and coming tech hubs. Affordability is also an attraction for Austin investors. According to the ULI report, Austin's affordability index, which compares the percentage of the median price of a home to the median income for the market, stands at 154.24. The report also points out there's a strong involvement among local owners and developers, indicating a substantial pipeline of real estate investment opportunities in 2015. So after looking at this list and trying to take into consideration all the other things that we know and that we don't know, and what this article doesn't talk about, there's actually a lot of things. It's also not just home to Dell. Apple also moved a lot of the U.S. corporate stuff to Austin. Their tech support is in Austin. There was a period of time in my life when I was doing real estate part-time and I was working for Apple as a technical guy. And during that time, they were moving people to Austin. I was actually given an opportunity. I was given an offer to move to Austin and move with the organization. Didn't take it. A lot of friends did. So the tech support organization has been there. You also got Texas Instruments, which is there. There's actually a very big bunch of tech guys that are out there. So it's not like this is something that's just started happening. This has been going on for decades. Apple's been there for over 20 years. I know Dell's been there for either that long or longer. I can remember people talking about other places they could work if they decided to leave Apple. One of the big concerns for tech people is if I move someplace with my company or if I am a tech-focused worker and I move somewhere and I decide to quit my current employer, am I stuck? Do I have to move back to California in order to make that work? I think people underestimate the power of that thought. So let's keep that in our minds as we consider Austin, because it's one of those towns where a high-tech person can think, if I decide to quit my current tech company, I can still find another tech job at another company there. That's a comfort level that's very important. Folks who are going to be big innovators in tech are going to want to always be able to have options. And a place like Austin, Texas gives them that. Next on this list is Dallas. One difference between Austin and Dallas is going to be the temperature, the heat. Dallas, I mean, I've never spent a ton of time in Dallas. Dallas has been a place I've had to stop while on my way to other places at the airport. I've driven through Dallas. I've stopped in Dallas. And every time I've been there, it's been too dang hot. So I can see where that might not be as attractive as some other places, just from a place to live standpoint. It's been a really long time. I haven't been to Dallas. So if this was something you were considering, and since I've been to Austin, I'm extremely comfortable with the recommendation made in this article that's a top market for you to come to, given the numbers we've talked about on this show before about Austin. Totally comfortable talking about that or suggesting it or seeing it as an option for you. If any of these places sound good to you, you should go and take a look. You should head out there, get out, see the ground truth of what's going on, talk to several real estate professionals. You should actually establish those relationships before you go and then see if it feels right for you. If you're someone who lives near these areas, this is a great opportunity for you to stop waiting and jump in. And if you've always said to yourself, wow, I'd really love to get into real estate investing, I would love to build ownership in homes so that can be sort of my retirement, so that when I've decided I'm not going to work for someone else anymore or do whatever else I do, I'm going to make my money off of rents. That's a great way to get started with that. It's the fourth best tech city in which to work, known as the home of Texas Instruments and sports and tech mogul Mark Cuban of Shark Tank fame. Dallas has its share of fast-growing VC-funded companies with IT services provided, CPSG Partners and real estate CRM developer, Think Tech Labs, among its 14 entries in the INC 5000. Its tech attraction and low median real estate purchase price of $197,000 translated into one of the country's highest job growth rates of 4.1%. With the job growth rate expected to continue, the ULI report names Dallas the fifth top U.S. market for overall real estate prospects. Like Austin, Dallas's strength comes in home building, where it ranked third, while pacing in the top 10 for investment and development. In terms of affordability, Dallas exceeds even Austin with a ULI affordability rating of 184.91. The expectation is investors' demand will remain high in 2015 thanks to a strong local economy supported by dynamic development. Okay. So here's another cool thing about the Dallas-Austin mix. Now, these places are not exceptionally close to each other. However, if you were someone who was worried about that dynamic, if you did have to relocate, it's nice to know you've got another tech hub within the same state. So while you as an investor, that might not make a bit of difference to you, you need to try to see this from the standpoint of the folks who will be coming here, because those are the folks that are going to make your rents higher or lower. The more of them who come, the more rents you're going to be able to get for your properties. So these are things that are occurring to folks who will be your customers. It's great to know who your customers are, right? It's great to know what they like, what makes them feel comfortable, what makes them willing to make the commitment to a new area. And something like this is something that plays into it. You know, back in the early 90s, again, this move to Austin by a lot of Apple folks, an interesting thing to note, back then it wasn't quite as leveraged as it is now. It wasn't considered as much of a tech hub as it is now. But a lot of those folks who moved there with Apple moved back to California within 18 months. If I'm remembering correctly, it was something like 50% of the folks who relocated. The dynamic has changed now so that it's become a lot more attractive for a more diverse set of reasons. So from an investment standpoint, Austin is absolutely a place that you would want to consider. In addition to the other things we discussed, the tech hub part of it plays into it. Okay. Next on our list, Seattle, Washington. Been to Seattle. Microsoft is there in Redmond. Amazon is also there, but Amazon's also right here in Sunnyvale in California. There's some really big Amazon offices right next to what used to be Moffett Naval Air Station off of the 101 freeway. I know that guy. I have a client who actually works on one of their tablets. I guess he works on their readers at that location. So that's here as well. But up in Seattle, that means we've got some good tech talent and tech jobs available. According to Startup Seattle, VC investment in IT companies in 2014 nearly doubled from 2013 as $804 million was invested in 139 deals, including $71 million of Series G funding for Redfin. Because of tech, Seattle is the fastest growing of the country's 50 most populous cities, 6.9% between 2010 and 2013. Most attractive to investors, however, is the steady climb in median real estate prices, which have grown 32% over the last 3 years to $440,000, while much higher than Dallas and Austin because median income is also higher. Seattle's affordability index still comes out at a respectable 98. So I have friends who live in Seattle. I've been to Seattle. I think in terms of attractiveness, it really depends on what you're looking for. I'll tell you what, I know an awful lot of people who've moved to Seattle and then left. So in terms of, and you'll want to look at this for yourself. That's true for these next two. These next two, I'm not as jazzed with. I've been to Seattle. I've been to the next one on our list. And neither one of these just inspire a lot of, yeah, let me go look and see if it's something I want to do. Now, Seattle is a beautiful place. You get a nice mix of hills and low country, a lot of rain, very green. If you're a water person, it's great, but you got to be a cold water person because that's the kind of water you're going to get. So I think that if you're treating this strictly as an investment, maybe something like this makes sense. I think that Seattle makes a lot less sense than, say, Dallas and Austin do. But if it's in your area, clearly it is an option that you should consider. If I live near Seattle, there's no question this is where I'd focus my effort just because of the proximity. All right, Chicago, Illinois is the next on the list. One of the country's major core real estate markets, Chicago ranks second in the growth of tech jobs among the country's most populous cities, 19.3%, slightly behind Silicon Valley, but ahead of Seattle. Not surprising, considering the base of business-to-consumer companies in and around Chicago, CareerBuilder, Orbitz, Groupon, Redbox, Motorola, and many others. It's also a haven for venture capitalist-backed tech companies with 29 companies in the Inc. 5000, including cloud solutions developer Max Digital and information sharing solutions developer Jump Forward. Here is what I would say about that. In the world of tech, a lot of it comes down to how sexy it is. None of the tech that seems to come out of Chicago is what's referred to as sexy tech. They're good tech jobs, don't get me wrong. But a lot of people are drawn, a lot of developers, a lot of the innovators are drawn to the sexy tech. And you see that in Austin. You see it a little bit less in Dallas. And of course, you see it here in Silicon Valley. So as in terms of desirability, I still think we're if we're talking about places that are outside of Silicon Valley where this hasn't happened yet, I still think Austin and Dallas hold the edge in a location like Chicago. Let's see. Median salary is 67% higher than the rest of Chicago's workforce for tech jobs. Another draw is the low median real estate price of $220,000, up 11.7% over the previous year. This combination gives Chicago an affordability index of 182.3 on the ULI report. Chicago's prospects for real estate in 2015 also ranked high on the ULI report, which placed the city at 18th overall in the strength of its investment. Nothing else sexy there. I will tell you, I mean, because I come, this, these locations are trying to entice people from here to go there. So when I talk to people about potentially listing their homes for sale, or I talk to people who are looking to me to consult with them a little bit on what their options are, there are folks who are being given offers to move to a place like Chicago, for instance. I mentioned that because it was within the last year I had someone contact me who worked for a tech company in Silicon Valley who wanted to move them to Chicago. And that's another interesting thing we can talk about in a minute. Companies that have actually closed their doors in California and moved to one of these other tech hubs. What was the company that guy worked for? Let's see. It was one of those websites that recommends people. So like an Angie's List kind of a thing. So I've had two clients contact me with concerns relating to their real estate needs. One was they worked for NVIDIA and they were concerned that their job was going to be disappearing. So they were looking to sell and move. What's interesting is the group that he belonged to believed that all of their jobs were going to India. So that's one thing. This other one was an Angie's List guy, and that has since happened, where Angie's List closed their doors in Silicon Valley and opened up an office for people to do the exact same work. And I want to say Chicago, but I'm not 100% sure. It was East. That's really all I can recall for sure. I don't know if it was all the way back to a place like North Carolina where there's another tech hub, but that kind of thing is happening. So when you're looking at this, it's also important to think there are an awful lot of people that are realizing it's just too expensive to continue to do business in California. I would expect the influence of these not California places to gain traction as it becomes more and more difficult to live in California. Whether it's from a tax standpoint, as a person, just an individual, or whether as a business operator. Now, as a business operator in California, I can tell you it's a pain in the butt to work in California. I myself am looking at options on being able to move to another state. So there was a point a few years ago where I got so frustrated, I actually was working on getting my real estate license in Texas. I've since reconsider that because I put a couple of more locations on my possibility list, which don't just include Texas. There's Texas. There's also Arizona. So there's that, which is just a side note thing. But what's interesting is to note that there is a movement afoot within Silicon Valley where business owners are really thinking, we don't need to be in Silicon Valley anymore to be an effective tech company. In the early 90s, unheard of. No one would say that. They'd say, we've got to be here. There are still some companies that for whatever reason feel like they have to have an office in San Francisco, for instance. I know a guy who owns a company in Silicon Valley. His offices are in Santa Clara, but he maintains a little office in San Francisco because of the optics, I guess, of it. In other words, when he meets clients from out of the area, that's where they go. That's all that happens there. There's a couple of meeting rooms. There's some people who maintain the site with cubes for folks who work remotely to come into the office and do that. But it's totally not day-to-day work, normal day-to-day work that's happening there. It's really kind of odd. That was a 8 or 9 year ago encounter. I don't even think they do that anymore. That is, it's what I'm saying, I guess, in a roundabout way and taking too much time doing it, is that this list, I think, is more relevant today than it's probably ever been in the history of Silicon Valley. There are, if we were to have this conversation in 1995, 1996, 1997, it wouldn't have even been a conversation. If you want to do high tech and you really want to be where the movers and shakers are, you had to be in Silicon Valley. With the evolution of what we can do in terms of communication, how people can connect, and how the web has evolved, and how perceptions have evolved, I honestly think that some of these locations have a really good chance of dethroning Silicon Valley. And a lot of that will be because a lot of these businesses have California's burdensome business practices just as fingerprints on their back as they get pushed out of the state. So I think things are coming together, and California is talking about doing more and more goofy crap when it comes to taxation, when it comes to how they make businesses jump through hoops, that it's going to become more and more attractive. Now, and imagine this, because this is another real world example I can provide you. There was a company, and this was an odd move. This was a move to, this was about 8-9 years ago, and this was a move to Las Vegas for a company. And this company offered all their folks a complete relocation package. They would move everyone. They would not reduce their pay. They would see to it that all of them got home loans for just a really attractive home loan guarantee package, and guaranteed them that every one of them would reduce their cost of living by, I can't remember what the number was, by X percent. So in essence, they were saying, by paying you the exact same amount of money we're doing and doing what we're doing, you will, in terms of how you feel it, be getting something like a 40, 30% pay increase because of this move. And I had a client who was involved in that process. They wanted to sell their house here. They were going to go ahead and go. Now, I haven't talked to that person since. If I recall correctly, that didn't last real long. And those folks ended up moving to another location within, I think, 3 years of doing that. But not back to California. They ended up moving. If I'm not mistaken, they ended up moving to Texas, because that client is still on my mail list. And I think they got something from me and responded with, "Hey, now I'm in Texas." And it was when I had done a show referencing Texas, and they mentioned it. So, interesting to see how things are migrating. All right. So Chicago, I don't have a lot of enthusiasm for Chicago, but it's on this list. So who knows? It may be an excellent place to at least jump in and start taking advantage of the market. Miami, Florida. Miami's tech scene has been on the rise this decade. Companies are locating in Miami either to reach Latin America or to provide a U.S. foothold for Latin American tech entrepreneurs. Miami startups brought in $49.4 million in VC funding in 2014, while existing VC-backed companies, including healthcare IT provider CareCloud and mobile app developer KiddoZen, saw continued success. Infrastructure investments by firms aimed at helping grow the startup ecosystem in Miami have led to 19 tech acquisitions since 2012. And then some unsexy stuff we don't need to talk about. While Miami's population was 4.8% from 2010 to 2013, and employment increased 2.9% in 2014 and is expected to rise more than 10% by 2017, real estate prices have remained relatively low at $225,000, even after an increase of 13.7% last year. These facts and the rise in construction led Miami to rank 9th in the ULI report, which also noted that continued improvements in Miami's economy will create increased investor demand and a lot of real estate activity in 2015. So... excuse me. So now, I used to live in Southern Florida for a little while. I lived there for a year and a half. Very hot, very humid. But I'll tell you what, it's because of its weather, because of its tropical feel, and because California, that's one of the things that I think keeps people in Silicon Valley. If we want to talk about the non-tech things that keep tech people happy, it's the idea that by working in Silicon Valley, you could start your day at the beach playing in the surf and end it by having a nighttime ski at Squaw Valley. So do people do that? No, but it really makes a great travel brochure headline, doesn't it? So that's something that people have to contend with. The weather here tends to be fairly mild. It's very comfortable. So all of that kind of works against folks who are trying to create tech hubs in other areas. So when you have to consider other places that will not only attract tech people but keep them, I think you also have to understand the climate and the community that they're going to. I just don't see Seattle and Chicago doing it. I just don't. I think Austin has a really good chance. I think Miami kind of has a chance. Miami's weird, though. I don't know how many hurricanes it would take for someone to decide Miami is not where they want to be. I was living in Deerfield Beach, Florida, when that hurricane hit in the 90s at some point. I was there for 18 months, 2 years. We had that crazy winter where Washington, D.C. was snowed in. It was ridiculous. And we went through that hurricane and you know, it was the very first time lightning struck like 30 feet in front of me, scared the bejesus out of me. But I don't know how many of those it would take. Now, I've lived through earthquakes and I don't even bat an eyelash anymore at earthquakes. I'm not sure I could ever become that complacent about what I went through weather-wise in Florida. So I, you know, I could see people potentially saying this will be great. And then they hit that first really crazy weather and things tend to go sour. So if you mix all of that together, and we are totally in Robert's windmills of the mind now, where we're just throwing out, you know, just casual observations, really hypothesizing here where the winner is going to be. And in terms of longevity, in terms of a proven history going back 20 years of it already starting, Austin, I think, is the clear winner in this list. I think Dallas would potentially be second. I'd have to go visit Dallas again. I remember Dallas being really hot. I remember getting off of a plane, walking into Dallas, and just having it come off in sheets and just wondering how the hell do people live here? You wonder, why would anyone settle in Dallas? What is there that someone would say, yep, this is where I'm going to build my house? And my theory was their wagon just broke down there. All right. This is as far as we're going west, I guess. We're done. And then they went ahead and started a town because the wagon that had all the important stuff on it broke down. But I could be totally wrong. For those of you who are in Dallas, I know I have a couple of listeners in Dallas. I have one listener in Dallas who I haven't talked to in a very long time, actually, now that I think of it. But anyway, I think Austin's kind of the clear winner, and I think Miami's maybe a second. Don't get me wrong. I had a good time. I when I was in the Southern Florida area, Key West was one of my favorite places. Word out to the LaConche Hotel in Key West, one of my favorite hangouts for a while, with a great bar on the roof to watch the sunset. So if you ever find yourself down there, that's the hotel to stay at. Anyway, so of all of the properties on this list, or all the locations on this list, I, you know, my bias is clearly towards Austin for both tech reasons and for interpersonal reasons, that it's likely to be a place that's going to keep people. Not only be able to start a tech presence, but able to keep the tech presence by not having brain drain, where the people who really bring a lot to the table in terms of technical expertise will go there and think, all right, cool. There's a lot of cool stuff you can do about Austin. You're not going to be doing any mountain climbing. There's not any mountains around Austin. Neither is there in Miami. Miami is pretty much flat. But if you're, I know for me, it became sailing and jet skiing and all that other kind of fun stuff. But there's definitely things to do if you sort of embrace it there. Seattle tends to be cold and wet and muggy at times. So I don't know. I just don't see it. I don't see Chicago either. I think it takes one winter of shoveling snow. And I think most of your high-tech guys are thinking, I want to go to a place where there's high-tech, but not quite so much winter. So I think that kind of makes Dallas, Austin, and Miami the potential winners, really. So there's my two cents on that particular subject. Let's go ahead and talk the foreclosure data here. I'm probably just going to wail right through this. I don't even think I'm going to take a break. Foreclosures increase in January, clearing the deck. There were actually two articles I came across over the last week that talked about foreclosures. One was from the LA Times. Foreclosures surge in Southern California, but for how long? The two big points they make there are foreclosures up in Southern California, but experts say it's banks clearing backlog, not a new round of bad loans. Repossessions hit two-year high in Southern California. That's another headline that I think is kind of misleading. It really makes people think things are happening right now, but no new wave of foreclosures expected. So let's talk about this. Nationally, foreclosure activity grew 5% from December to January. A month-to-month jump like that is stupid. What you want to find out about is the year-to-year jumps. Of course, there's a bigger jump. December tends to not be a month when people do foreclosures. It tends to be actually a month when things cool off a little bit in terms of people getting foreclosed on, and then they'll go back at it in January. Let's see, an increase of 5% from the previous month, but still down 4% from a year ago. So overall foreclosures are actually down from the previous year. That's the number you want. You want to plot it year to year, not month to month, because there's seasonal influences, as there are particularly between December and January. Here's what's interesting. Now this is a 15 month high, but what it speaks to is not a soft market, but a good market. It is lending institutions finally working through the backlog of homes because they see the market as robust right now and able to absorb the sale of these properties without diluting their value. And what I mean by that is if you drop a whole bunch of properties on them, and this is something we've been waiting for a couple of years. You know, we've had this conversation before on this show. We're just waiting for banks to sort of realize we can drop a chunk of our holdings and make the money back without seeing it negatively affect the market. Now, I argued that this point actually came both last summer and the summer before, where I think banks could have introduced an awful lot of their properties and sold them and not had it negatively affect prices. Not their whole holdings, not their whole set of holdings. So maybe this is what a lot of the banks were waiting for, was an opportunity for them to do a big dump. That big dump simply meant that they had to jump through the hoops to finalize the foreclosure and then be able to put these properties on the marketplace. So they're doing that this year. These are homes that are going to come on the market. Now, there's a variety of things that we need to learn from this. Number one is the banks seem to perceive that we're at the top. This seems to be what they were waiting for. They were waiting for a ramp up in prices and then a flattening, because to them, that indicates we've hit the top. We're there. So lesson number one is the banks believe that they are pretty much at a top, at a peak in prices, and they're trying to take advantage of it by liquidating their holdings now. Okay, that's a nice little tidbit. What else does it mean? Well, it means that we can expect to see these properties coming on the market. So let's mix that with another piece of data that we covered a couple of weeks back. That being that consumer confidence in terms of people who own a home, who believe that 2015 will be the right time to list their home for sale if they're going to list it, was up by 50%. Well, that's good news. That means a lot more people saying, I want to sell my house in 2015. Mix that with banks that are going to be putting homes on the market because they're foreclosing on them, or they're completing the process to foreclose. This should be a situation where now, one of the other pieces of data I should share with you is that a lot of these homes were originated over 10 years ago, or at least a dominant percentage of them were. So these are still old ones that are working through the system. If they're worked out far enough, these are situations where within the next 3 months, these are properties that banks should be able to put on the market and sell them. That's good news for the marketplace. We're going to see an increase in supply. But what this will do is it will continue to reinforce the flattening of prices. We've got enough demand out there to handle this, and I don't think we're going to see a lot of homes going down in value, but what we will see is a continued set of pressures, particularly because we've got foreclosures that are going to go on the marketplace, plus we've got a more positive attitude on the part of folks who might sell their home, indicating they're going to do it this year. So we should see an increase in just normal organic listings from people who own their homes, who want to sell it. And we should also see a bank-driven, foreclosure-driven increase in listings based on banks believing this is the time to pull their money out. Does that make sense? So this isn't really bad news. This isn't, oh, you know, foreclosures are up, markets are suffering. No, that's not what this is telling us at all. This is telling us that A, the banks believe we're at the top of the market. B, that we're going to see an increase in homes listed as banks liquidate the holdings that they've had, whether officially or not, right? They may not have completely foreclosed on some of these properties for whatever reason, but it's going to be a mix. It's going to be a mix of properties that they never finalized the foreclosure process, or they finalized the foreclosure process and held these properties back without selling them over all this time. And now they're going to be doing that. So for us, as people who keep our eyes on the real estate market and look for opportunities, this may be a good one if the amount of supply is increased to the point where it overwhelms demand. We may even see price decreases in some areas. That would be interesting to see. I don't see that happening here in my area. Now, if you're in an area that's already sort of enjoyed a bit of a recovery, I think banks that were holding properties in those areas have already liquidated those properties. I've mentioned to you before that I have several folks, appraisers and other people that I talk to on a regular basis that do a lot of work for banks, and they for a while kept reappraising properties every year that were owned by the banks. And this was clearly the banks trying to figure out what their holdings were worth each year to decide what they should do with them. Well, that has relatively dried up. My appraisal person was out doing that kind of stuff every single day up until early last year, beginning or end of the year before last year in 2013, where that sort of stopped happening. So, and those properties ended up going on the market. The banks saw that the demand was low, or excuse me, the demand was high and supply was low. So they took advantage of those in areas where it made sense to do that. If you live in an area where that's already been relatively hard hit, and hasn't had that robust recovery, still has some areas. I know there's some areas in Southern California, probably areas scattered all across the country, where what you're going to see is an increased volume of foreclosed properties coming on the marketplace that may prove to be a good opportunity for you when mixed with the idea that some folks are thinking this is going to be the year for sellers to sell their homes. So keep that in mind. I don't think there were any other really sexy tidbits from here. There was this last thing. Our agents, REO and distress business, has wound considerably down over the last 2 years, said Mark Hughes, chief operating officer at First Team Real Estate, covering the Southern California market. Despite a bit of an extension to this wind down process due to delayed actions created by the homeowner bill of rights in 2013, we're preparing for that. This is really a final push to clear the decks of a still disproportionate amount of distressed homes and finally bring the market back to more stability. So clearly they're seeing this as something that's going to affect the Los Angeles market. Maybe outlying areas up in my neck of the woods, south of here might be right. And even Gilroy is, maybe as far as Salinas. I don't mess with Salinas. But anyway, all right. Next on the hit parade for today's shows, home price growth picks up speed. Median price of existing homes in the fourth quarter was $208,700, and that's up 6% from a year earlier. This number will obviously vary from where you are, but the prices of homes actually quickened at the end of last year, and that depended greatly on the region. We talked about 6% being nationally. That marked a quickening pace from the third quarter when prices were up 4.8 from a year earlier. We're still right around that 5% mark, and that's about what we guessed on this show we'd see, something at 5% or less. It was absolutely at the top of what we guessed, but we were right there close to the right number. Of the 175 U.S. metro areas covered in the report, 86% registered increases in their median price on finalized sales in the fourth quarter from a year ago. In comparison, only 73% posted year-over-year gains in the third quarter. The biggest gains were seen in some of the areas hardest hit during the housing market downturn. Driving the gains, the supply of homes available for sale remained relatively tight, and demand was stoked by the improving economy and low interest rates. You know, I think it's really hard to give interest rates any credit for much of anything right now. Interest rates have remained relatively unchanged for an awfully long time. And if it proved one thing, it proved that there are clearly other concerns that people have about the real estate market that transcend interest rates. If interest rates were the huge deciding factor, tons of homes would be selling, and they are not. So there's clearly other things at work here. I know there's a lot of people hesitant. There's a lot of people not sure what to do. It's almost a mix of folks who aren't sure that it's gone down enough or that hasn't gone up enough. I mean, I get theories from all kinds of folks when I'm out there talking to them. And a lot of it depends on where you are. Las Vegas is still having problems and is struggling. So it really depends on what part of the country you're in. The volume of resales declined by 1% in the fourth quarter from the third quarter, nearly 5.1 million homes. The factors driving demand are pretty steady, said Danielle Hall, Director of Housing Statistics for the Realtor Association. The fact that demand is outpacing supply means that we see some acceleration in prices. Mortgage rates were quite low in the fourth quarter, and that played a role. Median prices increased most steeply in several cities in Nevada, Florida, Illinois that are rebounding from dramatic declines, as well as in smaller booming cities in Texas. The biggest gain came north of Dallas, where the Sherman-Denison area posted a 21.1% increase from a year ago to a median price of $128,200. Let's see. Many markets seeing the biggest price declines are in the Midwest and Northeast, led by South Bend, Indiana, which was down 7.9%, Hartford, Connecticut, down 6.8%, Cape Girardeau, Missouri, down 6.1%, Reading, Pennsylvania, down 5.5%, Appleton, Wisconsin, down 4.1%. Some cities seeing the biggest gains simply are small markets that often register big swings from quarter to quarter. Others like Naples, Florida area still are climbing back from their historic pricing levels after the downturn. Houston Association of Realtors reported that pending sales were down 9.3% to 3,382. Houston is also a town that's being kind of hard hit by oil. Since there was the decline in oil prices, a lot of that has had a ripple effect on cities like Houston. Houston's a huge oil town. I actually have a relative in Houston who retired from the oil industry about 8 years ago. The faster pace of home appreciation runs counter to the expectation of many economists that appreciation would start to slow last year, and this year as more supply hit the market, but that supply is taking longer to arrive than expected. Where else? Where's the other sexiness here? In Seattle, Redfin agent Klaus Gosma held an open house on January 24th for 24th and 25th for one of his listings, a three-bedroom home priced at $350,000. The open house attracted 132 visitors. The house, built in 2008, received 5 offers and now is under contract for more than the list price. Mr. Gosma attributed the house's popularity to a combination of low inventory and the price point being super attractive and affordable. So let's talk about that for a second from our ground truth perspective. Absolutely the case in my market right now. I showed a two-bedroom condo that's listed for $410,000 in Santa Clara. Was it Santa Clara or Sunnyvale? I think it was Santa Clara, with a view of the next door McDonald's. At least a dozen folks went through at the time I went through. It's crazy. It wouldn't surprise me if it's actually in contract right now. But in some areas, the market is absolutely nuts. And what's interesting is you can go just a few miles in other directions and see a completely different market. So a lot of what we've talked about here comes down to the micro market. Very important for you to understand that. A lot of the things that I talk about and the things that I personally experience on my marketplace aren't going to be directly what you're seeing where you are. Now, hopefully some of these things that we talk about can be things you can sort of use as a template to find areas that may not be showing the same kind of crazy high numbers, but you're seeing sort of the underpinnings that we talk about here that are providing those big numbers at play in some way in your marketplace, so you can predict the areas that are likely to give you the biggest return on your real estate investments. Okay. Homeowner tax breaks are probably safe despite moves in Congress. This is from the Los Angeles Times as well. Homeowner write-offs become targets for cutbacks whenever tax code reforms get serious attention. There's bipartisan support in Congress for a package of tax changes affecting businesses, but not individuals. So as an individual, I don't think, and I tend to agree with this article, I don't think anyone really has anything to be concerned about in terms of tax deductions relating to your ownership of real estate, unless you're a business. And I don't think any place more than California is going to see people get more hosed if you are a business owning real estate. Many benefits from tax breaks, such as mortgage interest and property tax deductions, plus tax-free write-offs of up to $250,000 or $500,000 of home sale capital gains, depending on whether they file returns as singles or married couples. Renters get none of these. I think it's also important to know, though, that these have not been decided. These are still things that a lot of folks are talking about doing in terms of limiting your ability to write a lot of these off. For those of us in California who have to pay the property taxes on our properties as well, the idea of getting some sort of a tax break from the ownership of property, it just makes sense. I don't know what kind of arguments folks can make in other locations, but these are also one of the first things that folks who think that the way to solve problems is to increase taxes is to go after the home ownership based taxes. So look for that to become a thing that gets argued. I don't think they've got the votes to make this happen in terms of owned real estate for individuals. If you are running things as a business that owns real estate, I think it's another set of problems for you. And nothing has happened yet, but I think there's a very good possibility that this year you'll see something occur that negatively affects your tax position as a real estate owning business. Next on the hit parade for today's show, landlords must disclose if tenants share utilities cost. Now, this is a big deal, and particularly in California, it's a big deal. If you are someone who rents a home, let's say that you're renting a home and on that property is a cottage, for instance, and you don't own the home, you're renting the main home and the landlord also rents the cottage. If the cottage is not on a separate meter, and you as the renter of the home are also responsible for the utilities, if you are responsible for the electric consumption or the utility consumption of that cottage, in addition to your own consumption, this is something that has to be clearly disclosed to you. This is a situation in this particular article where someone was renting a home, knew that the cottage was also rented, and in a casual conversation with the renter of the cottage, found out that that person does not pay utilities. And of course, the renter of the house knew they paid utilities, and then discovered that the cottage was connected to the utilities he pays for. The answer to this question is provided from the Los Angeles Times was that they're quite right to raise an issue with the landlord. There's a law dealing with this specific type of rental issue. Now, it's California Code, Civil Code Section 1940.9, and it imposes on landlords very specific disclosure requirements when there's a shared utility setup. Now, landlords are required with shared utilities to disclose the existence of the arrangement to all prospective tenants before they begin their tenancy. It's a duty to disclose. It's triggered when there are no gas or electric meters separately provided for each rental, and when the one meter records for billing purposes electricity usage for an external unit. It would therefore appear that the landlord in this case didn't provide for the disclosure requirement. So if you've got a property with multiple living units on it and you might have a situation like this going on, it's something you need to be very, very aware of, particularly if you're in California, because you may not be in compliance with disclosure laws. When this disclosure duty is violated, the landlord is required to take one of three actions. So if you're in a position where you're either looking at buying a property that has a cottage or some other rental property on it where you could rent as two separate units, these are steps you might consider taking before you do it, or consider them as a cost of buying the property in order for you to deal with this need without it becoming a cost you have to bear as the landlord. Because what it would mean is you'd have to roll these costs into the rent somewhere along the line, either by, for instance, if you had a situation where it was a house and there was a cottage and the utility bills were only being sent to the owner of the home or the renter of the home, you'd need to give them some sort of a credit on their rent. All this would have to be negotiated ahead of time, but it complicates the matter. And I think that from a landlord standpoint, you're better off doing something else to make this more stomachable to tenants. First option, the landlord can place the utility bill in your own name and be responsible for payment. That's a big one, but it also requires that you build into the rental rates what you think the utility bill will be. Now, because you're selling a product, right? You're not the only one renting a home in that area or in that city or in that town or community. You need to be competitive. Sometimes it's difficult to make folks aware, particularly on the primary sites. We're really talking about sites like Zillow, Trulia, where folks go to find rentals. It makes it difficult to make them aware that utilities are included. They'll just see the number, or they'll filter by the rent number not being higher than X when they've already budgeted for utilities, and your home gets excluded because you're above what their budget is. This is bad for you. So as a landlord, this would be the for a number of reasons. It's a pain in the butt for you to pay the utilities. Second, you never know. If you don't guess correctly, you could end up paying way more than you've tacked on to the rent to compensate you. It's just a bad way to go for you. And it's going to do nothing but generate arguments. You're going to resent your renters, and you don't want to get into that position. Next, the landlord can arrange for each rental unit to have its own meter. That's the thing to do. I don't have any numbers on what it costs. I know that I've talked to folks, and I can't remember if this was multiple units you had to do this on, having to come up with several thousand dollars to make this happen. The numbers we're talking about, and it's going to depend on where you are. I would imagine it's going to be a lot cheaper in some areas to get things separately metered than others. But my strong suggestion is that you consider this a cost of doing business, and you do it. Find out ahead of time what it will cost, and get it set up, because I think in the long run, it's going to make for a more healthy relationship between you and your tenants. And it's also going to be less of a headache for you. Next, the landlord can create a new agreement with you to specify how utilities will be divided. This is one way you can go. I don't suggest you do the first one. I think the first one is a loser for you. But you can create an agreement to specify how utilities will be divided between the two properties. Ways that I've seen it done are in a math equation in which the number of occupants versus the square footage is taken into account, so that the guy who's in the cottage is paying based on how many people are in the cottage and what the square footage of the cottage is. And then the person in the house is doing it based on the square footage of the house and the number of occupants. Because clearly utilities are going to be more expensive for more people. And also when you're heating and cooling a larger space. So those are the things you're going to want to take into account. I'd suggest you Google it and see if there's already any existing calculations to figure that stuff out. Now, if you don't do this, through one of these actions, the tenant can also file a court claim requesting reimbursement for utility expenses that can be attributed to the external rental unit. The beauty of this reimbursement remedy is that it begins to accrue from the date the duty to disclose arose, which in your case is at least a couple of years with the story that they were talking about. So remember, it's not just recoverable from the point at which someone finds it out. It's recoverable from the point at which you originally signed the rental agreement, where you should have disclosed it. So if this is someone who's been renting you for 10 years and discovers that someone's been, they've been paying the utility costs for someone else on the same ticket, then you could potentially be looking at a really huge amount of money that you're going to have to come up with. So it's something you need to be aware of as a landlord, and you need, and you know what? It's just a question of doing business. Honestly, it's, you need to set things up so that your renters are comfortable in what they're paying. Okay. Residential property values increased 5% year to year in December. We already talked about that. That was kind of our summary for the year. This is sort of the last thing I wanted to talk about today. Las Vegas real estate in January sales declined, non-contingent inventory up 3% year over year, 13% year over year. The total number of existing local homes, condominiums, and townhomes sold in January 2015 was 2,239, down from 2,734 in December of 2014. Again, month to month is stupid, but it's also down from 2,565 one year ago. So it's down on a year to year. In January, 9.7% of all local sales were short sales. Another 9.4% of January sales were bank owned. So that's about 20%, and that's not great. By the end of January, the local association of realtors reported 7,382 single family homes listed without any sort of offer. That's down 5% from 7,774 such homes listed in December, but up 12.9% from one year ago. So the number of homes not getting any offers is up almost 13% from a year ago. So Vegas is still having problems. I think it's really interesting to watch how Vegas is evolving through this problem. They still are clearly working through this. They are not on the same trail as the rest of us are becoming accustomed to. I still think it's an interesting market to watch. It definitely falls under that heading of a town that relies too much on a single industry, and that industry is suffering right now. I mean, we're not hearing good things economically about Vegas as a destination for, you know, the Sin City vibe and all of that kind of wonderful stuff. The whole, you know, what happens in Vegas stays in Vegas thing. It's just not happening as much. And that particular industry suffers, Vegas suffers. So there's just not a lot of diversity. I'm always a little concerned about communities that really rely on one or two industries to really make things happen. And I think Vegas is really an example of that. So, all right, let's go ahead and talk about what interest rates are doing. It's been a few shows since we did that. Not a whole lot of change. Interest rates in general, a little bit higher than normal. But over just since last week, they're actually down. But since the last time we talked about them, they're up a little bit, but they're still exceptionally low. The 30-year fixed rate mortgage is at 3.76%. Its 52-week high was 4.56, and its 52-week low is 3.55. So it's absolutely hovering down close to its low. That's a great rate, by the way. So no matter how you slice it, it's outstanding. The 15-year rate mortgage, 15-year fixed rate mortgage, is at 3.05. The 52-week low was 2.95. The 52-week high was 3.55. The FHA 30-year fixed is unchanged at 3.35, again, hovering down towards its 52-week low. The jumbo 30-year fixed is down 0.02% at 3.8. Its high point was 4.38 over the last 52 weeks, and its low point was 3.58. The 5-1 adjustable rate mortgage is also – everybody was down 0.02, just – because I don't think I mentioned it in each case, is at 3.13. That's just a little above its 52-week low of 3.08, and down, and its 52-week high was 3.26. So it's still hovering down there at its low end as well. But why anyone would get an adjustable rate mortgage at this point is beyond me. totally not the way to go, folks. So all of these interest rates are fantastic. They've been fantastic for a really long time. So folks who talk about interest rates as being this huge deciding factor in whether or not the market does well, I think is a little bit off. But maybe I'm nuts. The only other thing I would mention is I had a listener send me chips called Dang. They're Dang chips. They're coconut chips. This is a client who called me from Hawaii and knew that I had some interest in Hawaii real estate, and they were on Kauai, I think is where they said they were. So we did some chatting and I hooked them up with a really good agent in Hawaii, and they sent me Dang chips, toasted coconut chips with caramel sea salt flavoring and just some plain toasted coconut chips. They arrived yesterday. I opened up the caramel sea salt ones and tried them just before the show. Holy frijoles. They are awesome. So I wanted to, I should have mentioned this at the beginning of the show. I apologize. But thank you to the listener who sent those to me. I appreciate it. And these are delicious. And judging by, I can read the back here, only 3 ingredients. They're vegan, non-GMO, gluten-free, dairy-free, no cholesterol, and a good source of fiber. And they're freaking delicious. So I don't know where you'd get these. I've never seen them in a store. Maybe it's an Amazon kind of a thing, but hey, they're not paying me. No one's paying me to say wonderful things about Dang chips, but these things are freaking amazing. So if you ever get a chance to try them out, do so. All right. Little inside tip from the Rebel Broker. All right, folks. What the heck's going on? I turned on some audio and I'm not hearing it. That's why I'm sounding confused. I appreciate y'all taking the time to listen to what I have to say on these subjects. See, there it is. I appreciate you taking the time to listen to what I have to say on these subjects. I hope it's as helpful for you to hear it as it is for me to say it out loud. If you'd like to get in contact with me, there's a variety of ways to do that. Remember, the show is going to be migrating to be 100% on the www.therebelbroker site. So if you are finding it in any way relating to Blog Talk Radio, if you're subscribing to it through Blog Talk, if you're any of that stuff, stop. Contact me through therebelbroker.com. If I can help you buy, sell, invest in real estate in Silicon Valley, get in contact. Appreciate it. Thank you very much. I'll talk to you all next week.